Sportscast, December 12th, 2022. If you haven't yet, please subscribe in all our channels, YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, and Apple Podcast. You can also listen to us on your smart speaker. If you're listening on Apple Podcast, please leave a rating and a review. It will help us out tremendously. We're also on online radio 24/7. Visit our website, thesportscast.net, and also on Twitter, thesportscast1. And on Instagram as well. And check us out in our app, The Sportscast for iOS. The quarterfinals are over now into the final four, like we say here in America. The World Cup semifinals is here. And join us. It's been a week. Hal Phillips, author of Generation Zero. Welcome back to The Sportscast.
Thank you, Santi. Good to be here.
Yes, I want to start off with remembering Grant Wall. He is a soccer journalist. I've been following him for over 10 years. He is the premier, I would say. He died in Qatar on Friday during the Argentina-Holland match. And it was a surprise for everyone. We're still gathering what happened. But I know that Hal got interviewed by Grant, which is how I got to know Hal through Grant's podcast. But how can you tell us your memories with him?
Well, I don't want to overplay my relationship with him. I didn't know him at all until this summer when the book came out. But when that did happen, he was incredibly kind and generous. A real champion of the book, and had me on his podcast and published an excerpt. I couldn't thank him more for that. I mean, this guy is the dean of U.S. soccer writers, and he couldn't have been more generous. I don't know what else to tell you. He didn't know me from Adam, but he liked the book and really went out of his way to help me promote it. So, but you know, Grant Williams is a lot more than that. Obviously, he's, you know, the best soccer writer we produced, I would say, in the 21st century, and he's been at this a long time. I mean, I heard someone say, and I think they're right, that, you know, he's one of the few people who could really make this job work as a full-time job. And he worked very hard to do that. But I think his work speaks for itself. And he's not a cheerleader in any way for any kind of soccer. He was a serious news guy, which you could tell from the way he covered the Qatar World Cup, from the way he has talked about women's soccer in the same breath as men's soccer, always and consistently. And I'm sure he would have kept on doing that. It's just a tragic loss. And we were talking about it a little bit before we came on air, but you know, that Friday night, I had no idea what had happened. And I started getting texts from people, and it was just a terrible sort of slow drip of information. We can talk about, you know, the conspiracy theories surrounding it, but it was a very weird business when something like that happens. And I was, of course, watching the game like everyone else, the Netherlands-Argentina quarter, during the overtime of which this all went down. So it was a terrible, terrible business.
Yeah, I found out on Friday through one of my WhatsApp groups, and one guy just broke it. And I was like, I really thought it was a joke or something, and it wasn't. And there was, you know, more stuff was coming out, but prayers and all prayers to his family, and rest in peace. Let's start off with France versus England, a tight match. It was the heavyweights of all the quarterfinals. France beat England 2-1. France broke the deadlock in the 17th minute through Tchouaméni's long-range strike into the bottom corner, which was a beautiful goal, actually. England made a bright start to the second half, though, and were awarded a penalty after Saka was tripped and Kane fired it in the back of the net. Giroud restored France's lead, made it 2-1 in the 78th minute with a header from close range. And the Three Lions had another chance to equalize through a penalty, but Kane shot it over the bar, reminding me of Roberto Baggio back in the World Cup in USA. But what were your thoughts over this match, Hal?
Well, I'm a Spurs fan, so I felt bad for Harry Kane. And I put up my my favorite Tottenham beanie, you can see over my shoulder here, just to support him in his time of need. But, you know, I guess I was rooting for England. You know, those games sort of bring out your animal instinct. I don't have any great rooting interest either way. But, you know, as the game went on, I could tell I just wanted England to win. France has had a good run. It's time for someone else maybe to step up and try to win a World Cup. The English are as qualified as anybody else. But France essentially won this game and may win a second consecutive World Cup, not with its B team, but without five incredibly important and star-studded starters. What they have done with a midfield that I don't think anybody following the game in a cursory way would even recognize, they are going to maybe win two in a row, and they're certainly favored to do so. It was a very, very tight game, though, and I feel bad for Kane. It's difficult to take two penalties in a game. I've had to do it. You don't know quite what to do. I've certainly never done it against the goalkeeper that you've been training with on your club for 10 years. That must have been even weirder for him to try and do it twice. But one thing we can say for sure is that the English have found a new way to lose on penalties.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think what I would have done different, and hopefully other teams will do, is if you have two penalties, have your number one penalty taker do it, and then if it's after, have your other striker do it, like Foden or something like that, because I think the psychology behind it gets a little bit iffy. And of course, you know, these goalkeepers know they have these sheets of the probability of where that penalty kick will go, left or right or down the middle, the Palenka, which now they're showing it on TV. I remember how they would not show it. It would be a little bit too controversial, but now they're showing it in almost every broadcast. But this France team.
What Panenka aren't they showing?
Oh, no. Well, before the broadcast will never show that chart of where the taker would shoot. It's like, okay, it's like you see all like the little green squares and the red squares where they got missed or they got blocked or whatever. And it was like, I can't remember. One guy was telling me, maybe it was Grant Wallace said it actually, that it was kind of a little bit like, it's not a good idea to show it, but I'm trying to think why did he say that? But
they did show a chart before before his second kick. They may have shown it before the first kick. I honestly can't remember, but they've been showing charts because they keep this data and it's public. It's public domain. Why not?
Right. Yeah.
What's interesting to me is I think we're witnessing a tipping point in the way penalties are taken, especially in shootouts. But when you have a multiple penalty game by the same guy, the same premise holds. Kane never bought into the idea of the slow walk approaching the ball or maybe syncopating it to try to get the keeper to move if they're going to guess and just go the other way. He was not like that. He played the ball firmly into either corner and because he had chosen that side. I think that during this tournament, we're seeing that the slow walk approach is not working because keepers like the Moroccan keeper are staying at home and they are basically foiling that effort and foiling the Panenka and making the entire team, your opposing team, think twice about trying to slow walk and just choose at the last second. Both teams that tried that in the main during the two quarterfinals lost. And I think that it's going to go that way. But let me just add too that, you know, defending a penalty from the same shooter twice in the same game is also a weird mental disadvantage for Lloris, for the keeper there. It's, you know, he's got to make the same kind of machinations go in his head as Kane did. But I see what you're saying. You know, if you have another guy who can take it, might be a good idea. But Harry Kane is so good at penalties. Why wouldn't you have him take another one?
Exactly. So we'll see what happens. England that made it to the Euro final last year, actually, and the World Cup semifinal 4 years ago in Russia, slipped back in the quarters. Hey, it's a tough quarterfinal match against France. You know, it's something that you don't request, but it is what it is. You just got to play with the card you're handed to, and England did not accomplish. As you mentioned before, this French squad was missing quite a few players before the World Cup. You know, Benzema, Pogba, Kante, and of course, Hernandez. He got injured in the first match, but this French bench is pretty deep, isn't it?
Well, they're as deep as any squad in the tournament. We all knew that. Maybe the Brazilians could say they're as deep, but only in the attacking sense. These guys are deep all over. They have two teams they could field and do very well in this tournament, and they're showing that to us again. And the English showed us again that they really just cannot or have not or do not have the capability to beat excellent teams in tournament play. They really haven't beaten anybody outside of the confines of Wembley Stadium ever in major tournaments. It's really astonishing when you look down at the list at those teams. In 2018, I think they beat Colombia and Sweden to gain the semifinal, lost to Croatia. And then who did they beat in 2021 at the Euros? They had an easier track in before they played Italy at home, couldn't beat them at home. It's really quite amazing when you look at the track record in major championship play. The English have just never beaten anybody who's any good.
Yeah, that's something that they got to keep accounted for. And, of course, Gareth Southgate's job is in question marks, but he does have a two-year – he has 2 years left in his contract. So we'll see what the England FA will say in the next couple of weeks. The next match was a little bit – not much action. It was actually prior to this England-France match, Morocco-Portugal. El Nesri from Morocco scored in the 42nd minute, and the rest of the game was parking the bus, Hal. That was pretty much what I can say. And Ronaldo did not start from the beginning, but they subbed him in the second half. That didn't help out, and of course he left crying. And Morocco is the first African nation in the semifinals. Your thoughts over this match?
Well, I don't think they parked the bus in the same way that you do. First of all, they scored a goal. And when you score the goal, you're allowed to fall back and let people come at you. If it's 0-0, that's parking the bus. I thought their game against Spain and the game against Portugal were fascinating to watch. They do play just tenacious defense, but they do pick their spots and go forward, and they do it with incredible skill. I think the most impressive thing that I noticed from those two matches were just their confidence on the ball in their own third. They don't just whack the ball away. They play it out, and they're very, very comfortable doing that under the most extreme pressure. The Spain match was an even better example of this because Portugal doesn't quite have the all-court game, to mix metaphors, that the Spanish do. Spain really worked hard on defense in that round of 16 match. To win the ball back, put an enormous amount of pressure on the Moroccans, and they just never cracked. You know, it's an interesting metaphor. It's not a metaphor at all, but milestone, I guess. You know, the first African team, they certainly are that, and it's a massive moment for the continent. But I think if you asked Moroccans, and I have been to Morocco and I've talked about this, they consider themselves Moroccans first, and then they consider themselves Arab North Africans second. And only third, I think, do they consider themselves Africans. But yet they do play in that confederation, and I'm sure they're all rooting for Morocco, and frankly, I am too. But an amazing sort of post-colonial, neo-colonialist legacy matchup with the French coming up on Wednesday, I guess it is. And it's going to be a very fascinating match because this team can clearly defend with anybody in the world.
Yes, I have to give credit to El Nesri, fantastic player, and Hakimi, fast player. Oh my gosh,
and
fantastic.
Zajic is another very, very capable attacker, and their spine, you know, is very strong. Their central midfielders and their center backs are not only, you know, tenacious defenders, they are very strong on the ball and don't have any hesitancy to carry it and hold it and against any kind of pressure. I'm you know, super impressed with them. A lot of those teams would crumble and just start booting the ball away when they're ahead 1-0 late in the game or tied 0-0 late in the game, as they were with Spain. They did not do that. They were always dangerous, and that is impressive to me. It's not easy to quote unquote park the bus and go forward. They're able to do both, and that's why they are where they are.
Also credit to Yassine Bounou from Seville, 8.4 rating in Hot Mob, fantastic. And we'll see what happens against France, which just will lead to this segment. The semis, of course, the first match is Argentina versus Croatia. This is the third World Cup head-to-head, Hal, between Argentina and Croatia. And the first match in the second round, Argentina won 1-0 in 1998. Obviously, back then was Schuker, versus mm-hmm. El Burrito Ortega.
And yeah,
but I did not know this. I found out this morning, and I have a good World Cup memory. How Croatia beat Argentina 3-0 in 2018 in Russia.
I would not have remembered that either.
Exactly.
It were was they in the same group?
Same group. I believe it was that third match where it like they were already like qualified to the round 16, maybe. But that happened. And this will be Croatia's first World Cup game at Lucel Iconic Stadium. Doesn't mean much, to be honest. it's a stadium, to be honest.
If it was like in the middle of the desert, there you go.
Middle of the desert, they're all AC'd. You know, compared to back in the U.S., yeah, you play in the Rose Bowl coming from New York, there's a difference.
Yeah.
But this match is going to be interesting. Argentina had a, you know, actually both teams had to go to penalty shootouts. So like they both have experience, some confidence there. I think the Argentinian keeper is definitely feeling confidence because he's stopped two balls against Holland. But what are your thoughts over this match?
Well, I think it's always important to when you're watching a major tournament play out, is to keep an eye on the teams that get better as the tournament goes on. Certainly Argentina has done that. Their first game was terrible. And we've talked about it, and I guess there's no point in talking about it anymore because it's pretty meaningless. They lost to the Saudis, but so what? They have gotten a little bit better in every match, and I don't want to obscure the bulk of their performance against the Dutch, which, you know, allowed them to be up two goals with 10 minutes to play. They played a very cagey and ruthless match. Wow, that was the most ill-tempered match of the tournament, and it was fascinating to watch it. I've never seen a bench react the way the Dutch bench reacted when I think it was Otamendi fired that ball, you know, off the pitch into the bench area of the Dutch. They got up and came off that bench like it was a bench clearing brawl in the NBA or something like that. That was amazing response. I've never seen that. So we've all seen the pictures of the Argentinians goofing on the Dutch when they won the penalty kick. That was more classy behavior from the Argentinian players. But anyway, the Argentinians they're not a perfect team. They are riddled with deficiencies, but I do believe they have gotten better and better as this tournament has gone on. So I think that bodes well for him. But what we know about the Croatians is they do this all the time. They start a little slow. They get their shit together, if you will. And then they start reeling off victories. You can't put them away. They're getting better too. So something's got to give in the semifinal. And anyone who bets against the Croatians because they're not a name is just being foolish at this point. They win games with alarming consistency in these tournaments, and they're a complete team. I think the Argentinians are more complete team than we want to give them credit for. Emotionally, they might be a little immature, but as a collection of talent, they are getting better, and they're pretty strong. They really do miss Lo Celso, though. If they had him playing on the left side of midfield behind their attacking troika, I think they'd be a little more dangerous. But Messi's healthy. They've got these young studs to complement them. Otamendi, I think, is just an accident waiting to happen. He's another one of these 35-year-old center backs. This tournament seems to feature a ton of them. Vertonghen and Alderweireld for Belgium. You know, they as soon as you saw that, I was like, well, how can this team be any good if they can't find a center back, you know, younger than either of these two? Silva was caught out, you know, against the Croatians many times. That Hutchinson fellow who played for Canada, 39 years old. I don't know how you can field the team seriously in the World Cup with such old center backs. The pace, the slow turnaround between these games, physically, it's got to be taking a toll. So I would keep an eye on those center backs for Argentina to see whether or not Kamaric and Modric and company are able to take advantage. Petkovic, of course, didn't do anything in that game against Brazil until he set up the goal.
Do you think this Argentina squad would be tougher or easier for Croatia versus Brazil?
I think it's an easier setup for Croatia, frankly. I think they can feel a little more free going at these guys. But, you know, Croatia just doesn't do that. Croatia is an incredibly mature, confident, and patient side. They don't ever feel the need to go at anybody and get ahead because they're going to get ahead and hold on. They get stronger as the game goes on. We saw this in 2018. They are clearly super fit, and they never waver. They have great goalkeeping. They win penalty shootouts, so they don't care about finishing there. They have enough scoring, and Modric is just a wonder. I mean, to the idea that he's that young, that old, and is still running around midfield with such endurance is spectacular. I don't know what they'll do when he's gone, but, you know, the Croatians have fielded several generations of great teams now, and 4 million people in that country, they clearly punch more above their weight than any side in world football. If the Icelanders aren't around, got to give the Croatians the nod there.
Argentina will be out with two players for suspension, Gonzalo Montiel and Marcos Acuna. And there is some injury worries about De Paul. So we'll see if he's ready game day. And the replacement for Acuna will probably be Tagliafico. That's a tough name to pronounce. We'll see what happens there. But I think the key to Argentina to beat Croatia, obviously, is Messi. And how important is Messi to Argentina? Because that pass he did against Holland, how was like, I mean, I don't watch La Liga matches too much or PSG, but that was one heck of a goal, wasn't it?
It was beautiful. And let's give credit where it is entirely due. Taking that ball with a touch from Messi in that spot, running on goal at that angle, was incredibly difficult. And he took it and finished it so beautifully. You know, they have these abilities to slice you open, but they haven't blown anybody out in this tournament. They have flaws themselves. I'm not going to go ahead and pick. If I had to lay money on this game, I wouldn't lay it on Argentina. Look at two of the four semifinalists we have. No one would have picked either one of them to be anywhere near these matches. So I'm excited to see the match. I think it's going to be an amazing matchup. I hadn't thought back what kind of history they have between the two of them. That's really fun. You can work up some bad blood against Croatia with that many matches. They can do it against the Dutch. Hopefully they'll do it against the Croatians too, because that's good for the neutrals.
And like the time they faced in 2018 was match number two in their group. So that was kind of interesting. We'll see if that might repeat this time around. France versus Morocco. France high-powered offense. Morocco high-powered defense and goalkeeping. France has no injury issues, no suspension issues, and also Morocco is fresh. Their striker Walid Shadira has two yellow cards, but this squad, I mean, this match is going to be interesting. High-powered offense. So far, France hasn't had problems scoring goals. We saw a little bit more of Tchouaméni last match. Giroud scoring. No Mbappe score last match. We'll see if it changes, but this might be, will this be close, or is this going to be a blowout by France?
Well, we don't know, of course. That's why we watch. But I suppose if we include players that didn't participate in the quarterfinal because of injury from France, those half dozen studs, we should include Mbappe, who did absolutely nothing against the English. He was not dangerous, and he's due to be dangerous. And I'm not sure whether the Moroccans will man mark him like Walker did for the English very effectively. I guess if I was being pushed for a prediction, I would expect the French to blow him out. I think that if they can get ahead in this game, the Moroccans are going to have to do something they're not comfortable doing, which is come out of their shell a little bit and go forward. And when you do that against someone like Mbappe and someone trailing a play and a finisher like Giroud, that's trouble. And at this point, Moroccans have had an incredible run. They're probably exhausted. They're not as deep as the French. And it wouldn't surprise me if this game got out of hand, although I'm not predicting that it will. But if there's a 3-0 scoreline for either of these semifinals, I would choose France and Morocco.
Yeah, this might be the most predictable match, I would say. The other one, Argentina-Croatia, might be closer. That's my prediction. Not ours, but mine at least. But we'll see what happens. Before we head into final predictions, Al, there was a story this past weekend, yesterday actually, about Gio Reyna and Berhalter. Berhalter was at this leadership conference, and he talked about there was one player that was having issues. He said one of the 26 players that stood out. As a staff, we sat together in for hours deliberating what we were going to with this player. We were ready to book a plane ticket home. That how extreme it was, and it came down to we're going to have one conversation with them, and part of our conversation was how we're going to behave from here out. There aren't going to be any more infractions, quote by Berhalter. And then there was an article later on that night from The Athletic, from Paul Ternero, and he said that it was Gio Reyna who showed lack of effort in training prior to the opening match of the tournament. There was also a friendly with a Qatari club named Al Gharafe, and there was just lack of effort, lack of intensity. And also heard that some of the players were talking, hey, man, you know, snap out of it. And apparently Reyna was down because he knew he wasn't going to start against Wales. So there was some little bit of friction there. I mean, friction there between the coach and Gio Reyna. And that's why everyone was asking, where's Gio Reyna? Almost every match, everyone was asking about Gio Reyna. So I guess the answers are filtering. But what was your thoughts over last night's story?
Well, we spoke about this, I think, the last time we potted together, Santi, because we were talking about how Eric Winalda had come on saying that had gone public with conversations with Claudio Reyna about how he was upset that Berhalter had basically asked the player to feign an injury to explain why he wasn't playing. Winalda has since retracted all of that. And here we are in a situation where clearly there was some, yeah, I'm going to call it misbehavior, because if you show up at the World Cup and dog it, you know, because you're not starting a game, I call that misbehavior. But the people who want to get rid of Greg Berhalter are determined, you know, to take Gio's side and say that the two players that did approach Reyna apparently were Yedlin and Aaron Long. But apparently those players aren't good enough. They're MLS players, so of course they can't complain. They just have to let the star child do whatever he wants. It certainly explains a lot, doesn't it? I think that it wouldn't surprise us. It wouldn't have surprised us if Berhalter had decided not to start him in the Wales game. The guy is coming off injury. He's not been in the cycle like others had because of those injuries. And we know Berhalter. He has this set team that he likes to play, and that's the way he started. But it was the reaction to this that was really the root of this problem. And, you know, if you have a player who's, you know, throwing his shin guards around and not because he's not starting a game and dogging it in practice, apparently that was really what put them over the edge. Was after this episode, he didn't snap back and sort of get with the program. He was even more petulant between the Wales game and the England game. And I think Berhalter sent a message to him when he put Morris on. People, but look at the way we're interpreting that. When that went down, people were just gobsmacked that Berhalter would put Jordan Morris on before Reyna. Well, now we know why, and it makes perfect sense. If you are a coach and you're trying to maintain a, you know, esprit de corps at a tournament, not over the course of a year, but at a tournament, his behavior makes logical sense to me. And I think the team backed him, is what the impression I got from the reporting. Wasn't just Yedlin and Long. It was the entire team that made him actually take ownership of that in front of, you know, he tried to issue an apology and they pushed it. They said, well, what the fuck, dude? Why did this even happen? They pressed him on it, which is what a team does when they are annoyed that he's been dogging it at the World Cup because he's not playing as much as he'd like. Look, the guy's 19. I don't think that we can expect incredibly mature behavior from any 19-year-old. I will go on record and say right now that I'm not prepared to defend 90% of what I did as a 19-year-old, but it sure explains a lot to me. And to watch the Berhalter haters out there try to make sense of this and argue that he should step down now because he betrayed the player's confidence and threw him under the bus, it's just ridiculous. I'm no great lover of Greg Berhalter, but I mean, how can you interpret it that way?
Yeah, this will definitely prompt to maybe perhaps decisions to, you know, if Berhalter will stay or not for the U.S. manager coach. So we'll see what happens. I think it was kind of surprising. Not surprising, because it was always like every match I would hear fans talk about, you know, where's Gio? Where's Gio? Put Gio in. And he played very few. I think he played for like 10 to 20 minutes. It wasn't that much in all the three matches. So,
well, he played 7 minutes against England, which was obviously just token. It was against Iran. But then he played the entire second half against the Dutch. So it wasn't like he didn't play at all. And that, again, that at least makes more sense in the context of this situation to throw him on for a half an hour or a second half against the Dutch. If there was nothing going on like this behind the scenes, would make no sense to me at all. And that's where we all were until this story broke and essentially explained everything I need to know about what happened. Go ahead.
From this point, do you think Berhalter will be back or not?
I couldn't begin to say. I think that if you're the Federation, his situation is probably a lot stronger. It seems clear that this was an off the record discussion that someone went public with at this conference. That can happen, but it's not like he named the guy. Someone else came in and named Claudio, you know, Gio Reyna for Berhalter. He didn't, you know, he didn't do it. I sound like a Berhalter defender. I want Berhalter to come to his senses and recognize that two cycles is a very difficult ask of any manager, and certainly one who has so little experience as Berhalter. If he did such a great job, he should go and reap the benefits of that job by fielding one of the many offers I'm sure that he's had dealt to him, and he should go to get on with his life. If you're going to play it, you know, close to the vest, I would like the Federation to bring in a name, a European name, because clearly that is the kind of manager who will speak best to our stars, who will be able to instill a little more strategic thought and tactical thought to their games. They'll see it as a value add. And look, if things don't go well, I guess we're hosting the Copa America in 2024. We haven't talked about that, but that looks like it's going to happen. That's the perfect benchmark for someone like, I mean, Pochettino. I'm a Tottenham guy. I think he'd be a wonderful hire. Give him 2 years. And if it works out, you keep him on for the World Cup. But suppose it doesn't go well. Suppose we get run out of the Copa America in 2 years. Well, then you go and get Jesse Marsh, because he will have been fired by Leeds by that time, and you can go with an American. But there's no law that says you can't finesse this situation. But if Berhalter stays, there's no finessing. It'll be very difficult to get rid of him. Something will have to go very wrong, because if suppose he gets to the final of the Copa America, then you can't fire him.
You can't. That is a benchmark, which, yeah, there is rumors, Copa America, well, strong rumors, let's just say, yeah, that it will be coming to the States. I believe Ecuador pulled out. Your thoughts on that? You think that's going to be a smart move, I bet?
I think it's essential that that the Americans participate in the Copa, not just in 2024, but going forward. Because of CONCACAF, both the U.S. and Mexico have trouble fielding strong opponents between World Cups. Our Gold Cup just doesn't have the drawing power of, the competitive dynamic of a European Championship or a Copa America. You need to be involved with those just to play the matches against quality opponents. The problem is we actually play pretty well against South American sides. For whatever reason, we do. We play terribly against European sides. We really need more high-profile games against European sides, but there's really no good way to do that when the international calendar has been stacked the way it has been stacked with Nations League matches and CONCACAF Gold Cup matches and now Copa America matches. There's just, you know, those are friendlies when you get a European game, and we need more of those, and they're not inviting us to the next European Championship, that's for sure.
Yeah, and especially their Nations League puts them with less friendly opportunities. So it should be interesting what happens. Late breaking news, Al, right during the show, Gio Reyna releases a statement, I believe on his Instagram. Let me pull this up. He said, I hope not to comment on matters at the World Cup. It is my belief that things that happen in a team setting ought to remain private. That being said, statements have been made that reflect on my professionalism and character, so I feel the need to make a brief statement. Just before the World Cup, Coach Berhalter told me that my role at the tournament will be very limited. I was devastated. I am someone who plays with pride and passion. Soccer is my life, and I believe in my abilities. I fully expected and desperately wanted to contribute to the play of talented group as we try to make a statement at the World Cup. I am a very emotional person, and I fully acknowledge that I let my emotions get the best of me and affect my training and behavior for a few days after learning about my limited role. I apologize to my teammates and coach for this, and I was told I was forgiven. Therefore, I shook off my disappointment and gave everything I had on and off the field. I am disappointed that there is continuing coverage of this matter, as well as some highly fictionalized versions of events. Interesting. And extremely surprised that anyone on the U.S. team, men's team staff would contribute to it. Coach Berhalter has always said that issues that arise with the team will stay in-house, in quotations, so we can focus on team unity and progress. I love my team. I love representing my country, and I'm focusing now only on improving and growing as a soccer player and a person. I hope that going forward, each person involved in U.S. soccer focuses only on what is in the best interest of the men's national team so we can enjoy great success at the World Cup in 2026. So there you have it. He said limited role got him upset. Your thoughts on this statement, Al?
Well, so in my real life, Santi, I run a media company, Mandarin Media, it's called. We do strategic PR. And this is a very strategic piece of PR. Note the very subtle deflections in this comment. It's not that he was told that he was not going to start against Wales. That's what has been reported. It was that his role would be limited throughout the competition. And that's what made him upset. I don't even know if a Berhalter hater would think that Berhalter would be so stupid as to tell any player that they weren't going to play, that your role is going to be limited, no matter what happens. And even after all of this did happen, he started him and played him for 45 minutes in the second half of their only knockout round game. So that doesn't strike me as a truthful sort of statement on Reyna's part. Then he cops to being over emotional and letting that get in the way of his training. Now, if this was any other player, not someone that soccer Twitter has been pushing, you know, for more time for a month, I think we'd laugh at his presumption. Well, yeah, and after that happened, while we were at the World Cup, I sulked and didn't give my best because I'm an emotional person. I'm 19 years old. You can't expect adult behavior from me is sort of what I read into that. I think he's pissed that it came up. But again, I'm not sure how much we are allowed to blame Berhalter for publicly calling this guy out. He did not do that. He never named him. And he did it in a closed forum that I don't think he thought there was any press at. In fact, I don't think there was any press there. Somehow it was leaked. So a pretty terrible situation to leave the World Cup on. And I don't know. What do you think? Am I reading too much into it? Am I too much of a Berhalter supporter?
No, you're right on it. I mean, should a coach tell a player that, hey, your role is going to be limited before the World Cup? I mean, things could change in the training, Hal. Like, hey, wow, you look great. I mean, you've been having a fantastic performance, the field of practice. But how many coaches or how many international coaches before the World Cup tells, hey, you're going to have a limited role?
I don't think that's just it, Santi. I don't think that he said that. I think he said, we're not starting you against Wales.
Yeah, pretty much.
And now the pivot, once all of this has gone down and you throw your shin guards and pout, what is said or what he's claiming was said to him is you're not, you know, your role is going to be limited throughout the World Cup. No coach is ever going to say that. You're exactly right. And I don't believe he did say it.
Quite interesting. We'll see where this goes. Maybe Claudio Reyna might say something, maybe not, but still a couple weeks. Hey, yes, I know this is drama and everything, but hey, you know, this news would not have happened 20 years ago in the U.S. It would have been not even on the newspaper. Which is kind of, it kind of reminds me of that John Hark's Winalda issue where I guess, was it Winalda that cheated on John Hark's wife? Kind of similar after drama there, but.
Let's be accurate. Hark slept with Winalda's wife.
Winalda's, yeah, opposite. Totally forgot.
And Hark's was the captain of the team and was not brought to the 98 World Cup because of it. But I thought and you Hark's were going somewhere else with that, Santi. I thought you said that this is actually indication of just how much people care about soccer now in 2022 compared to 1998.
And, it's unbelievable.
Know, yeah, you're talking to the guy, the author of Generation Zero. That's been my bailiwick for 6 months talking about this book, is that the amount of coverage that that soccer now gets in America is a result of the change that happened in our culture in 1989. That's the subject of my book. And we wouldn't have had, you can't foresee soccer Twitter, in 1990, but to have mainstream major media talking about this, little tiff from the World Cup with such depth and such breathless anticipation shows you that soccer has come a long way in terms of its mainstreaming.
I totally agree. Generation Zero, which you can find the link below in the description, which I will talk a little bit later after the predictions. So let's segue to something a little bit more positive. First match, Argentina-Croatia. Yes, you mentioned Croatia, but give us a score with that.
I find that with these predictions, I can't get away from my desire to create a final that I want to watch. So I'm going to pick Argentina 2-1 over Croatia, and I'm going to pick France 3-0 over Morocco because I want that final. Yeah. Because Brazil, because Croatia took Brazil Argentina semifinal away from me. I'm going to punish them psychically.
Yeah, Messi versus Mbappe will be something that a lot of people will love to see on a Sunday morning. So we'll see what happens. How? What is the best way to reach you online and also about your book Generation Zero?
Well, yeah, I do tweet from @MandarinHal. So, yeah, check me out. Some likes. Generation Zero, the story of an American generation born in the 1960s, raised in the 1970s as our first true soccer natives. And you see those guys on the cover. All of those guys participated in the youth soccer revolution of the 1970s. And, oh, by the way, all the women who participated in the 1991 World Championship effort were of the similar, vintage. They all grew up at the same time, and come 1990, they changed our soccer culture. They changed our sporting culture by finally showing Americans what soccer was about and also cluing them into what fun international competition is. Look at all the gossip that we're getting out of this nice international competition. Americans didn't indulge in any of this stuff before 1990. It really was a tipping point in our sporting culture. So, yeah, pick it up on Amazon, Generation Zero.
Generation
it's a bestseller.
Zero. There you go. Make it a bestseller. And you can find the link below on the description. And you go to thesportscast.net. You'll find the link there. And also follow our Twitter, thesportscast1 on Twitter. And also Instagram, thesportscast1. But there you have it. The final four of the World Cup is Tuesday and Wednesday. Should be exciting. And then, of course, the finale this weekend. Hal, any closing words before we head off on this beautiful Monday?
Well, peace and solace to Grant Wall's family. That was just a terrible blow. And, he'll be remembered very fondly and for a long time. We'll miss him.
Definitely. Rest in peace. And let's get this World Cup going. Hal, thanks for coming on to the Sportscast.
Always my pleasure, Santi.